Hey everyone, welcome and thank you for tuning in to our program in these interesting and chaotic times. A lot of things going on. As usual, I'm Henrik Palmgren from Sweden in Scandinavia, and this is Red Ice Radio. We are an independent radio program that goes far and wide in a search for answers to many of our questions. We speak with people from all walks of life, really, allies and enemies alike, to inquire in an effort to understand better what we are facing. You know, our mission is not to promote, per se, the speakers on our program, but to investigate. And in the process, we hope that you can come to a better understanding of the things that we discuss, but also get a better idea of whom you are listening to. And we hope that our questions can help aid you in the process to learn more. But please question everything that you hear on this or any other program out there. That's the most important thing to remember. We have a somewhat different program for you today. Uri Geller, the Israeli spoonbender, is with us. And although we are going to talk a little bit about his past, the development of his claimed abilities, and where this actually came from, and some of the people that have helped him along the way, we are going to focus on a more darker aspect, if you will, namely Uri as a psychic spy for both the Israeli Mossad, but also for the CIA. And how his work connects with the development of the remote viewing program at SRI and the Pentagon. If you're a regular listener and have listened to us for a while and know some of the things that we've talked about previously, both from a more occult point of view, but also from a geopolitical perspective, I think that this is a very interesting program. So listen up and see if you can put some of the pieces in place after this one. Welcome, Uri. Thank you for coming on Red Ice Radio. It's very nice to talk with you and that you've taken some time off your busy schedule to speak with us here today. How are you, Uri?
I'm fantastic, and thank you very much for having me on your program.
You bet, you bet. So we watched the documentary yesterday, The Secret Life of Uri Geller. And of course, this is based on the book as well. We watched both the BBC version and the uncut one that was a bit longer as well. And they sure did cut out some interesting stuff from the BBC version. But nonetheless, I guess I was really surprised, or, you know, how candid you were when it came to talking about some of the work that you've done for the, you know, the Mossad, the Israel's Mossad, the Institute, or those who don't know, the Institute for Intelligence and Special Operations there in Israel. You also talked quite candidly about, you know, your time with the CIA as well. So let me ask you first, why did you want to write about these topics, and are all of them pretty much okay for you to talk about at this length?
Well, look, Henrik, what happened is that the BBC approached me about a year ago, and they asked me whether I would be interested in doing a documentary which they would produce about my secret work. Now, throughout my life, Henrik, I would say in the last four decades, when I wrote my books, I used to kind of subliminally hint that I was doing some other work for secret service agencies around the world. But somehow that was never taken seriously, or people thought that I was making it up just to enhance the book and make it more exciting. And when I was asked to do this BBC documentary, I thought that they will get nowhere. And I just went along and I said, sure, if you would like me to participate in such a documentary, just let me know when and how. What I didn't realize is that the BBC, to those who do not know, the British Broadcasting Corporation, it's the largest, you know, media outlet in Britain. They got a director called Vikram Jayanti, who is an Oscar-winning director, a very charismatic individual, and they made him the director of this documentary. Now, he, with his charisma, personality, character, and I guess the Oscar under his wing, he managed to wriggle himself into some very interesting individuals who, to my amazement, talked. So I was very careful what I said, and I have to be careful to what I admit or even what I deny. And that's how it came to be. Now, Jonathan Margolis is a British journalist who writes for the Financial Times and The Guardian here in England. He wrote immediately a book that is much more extensive than the documentary. And that's how the whole thing was born.
And as far as I understand it, Uri, the book is a little bit more centered around maybe the CIA activities as opposed to the Mossad, correct?
No, both.
Both.
Both the CIA and the Mossad. And you know, Henrik, just so you'll understand, if I may, let me kind of unfold or unroll to you how it all started.
Certainly.
Of course, you can jump in, you can ask me anything you wish. Later on, you know, we can kind of roller coaster through the chronology of my life, if you wish. But it all started when I was about 7 years old. I'm an Israeli. I was born in Tel Aviv. And I was in, you know, in a religious class, doing a religious lesson. And this amazing story came up from the Bible about the 12 spies that Moses dispatched to the land of Canaan. And it fascinated me. Indeed, those 12 spies entered Canaan. Moses wanted to know what was in that land, whether the land would yield fruit and food, and who lived there, and what type of warriors were in rule of that country or the land. Now, I was so riveted and mesmerized by this story that it ignited something in my mind to become a spy. I loved that idea. I wanted to be the spy. I wanted to emulate almost with that biblical story. Now, let's go quickly, kind of almost 10 years ahead or 7 years ahead. My parents divorced, and my mother took me with her to Cyprus, where she married a Hungarian Jew who lived in Nicosia, the capital of Cyprus. He died a year after getting married to my mother from a heart attack. He owned a little hotel, a bed and breakfast establishment with 14 rooms. Now, the Mossad somehow found out that we were running that little hotel. We were both Israelis. My mother was a Hungarian Jew, and I was born in Israel. And they took over this little hotel, and they made out of it a safe house for the Mossad, kind of unknown to us. They just engaged the rooms. And by the way, Henrik, stop me if I'm going on and on. And
no worries. Go ahead, Uri. We're interested in listening to this. I'll jump in later and ask you some questions about this. Okay.
Because I want to kind of paint you the background of how this all began.
Yes.
Now, I met an Israeli spy there called Yoav Shaham. Obviously, you know, I was only 12 or 13 years old. I bent a spoon for him. It freaked him out, and I read his mind. And then I said to him, Yoav, you're an Israeli spy, aren't you? And there was silence, and he was astounded. And he said, why are you saying this? What are you talking about? And I said, I know you're an Israeli spy. So he said to me, look, Uri, I don't know how you do this, and I don't know how you bend spoons and keys, but I do not want you to tell anyone what you've just said, but I do want you to do an errand for me. When I will be gone away from this hotel, from your hotel, I will be sending you letters. Letters will be arriving from many different Arabic countries. There'll be letters from Syria, from Egypt, from Jordan, from Iran, and you do not open them, jump on your bicycle and cycle to the end of the consul. So you can imagine, Henrik, this was, I mean, I was 12, 13, wow, this was James Bond, this was the movies, these were all the spy films and the war films that I loved, and that's how it all started.
Now, it's very interesting in this in the movie as well, because it details some of this. And one thing I believe that was kind of left out, if I perceive this correctly, is how you know, the story talks about how you went to Mexico and from there basically contacted by the CIA and everything else to kind of get you involved in that work as well. But there is a backdrop to this as well, as far as I understand it, and that has to do with Andrea Puharich and his Roundtable Foundation as well. He set that up, I think, in the 50s or something like that. That was eventually disbanded. But this one 14 Times article, I think you have it on your website as well, talked about how Puharich met you in Tel Aviv in 1971 and hypnotized you. Is that story correct?
Absolutely correct. And let me elaborate on it, because that's where, you know, the skeptics, and we can, you can ask me anything about skeptics, and we should talk about that side too, because I'm hugely controversial, as you know. But what happened is that Yoav instructed me to go back to Israel when I'll be 18, join the paratroopers, go to officer school, and then find him. And I said, how am I going to find you? He said, you'll find me. And I did exactly what he said. Went back to Israel, joined the paratroopers, went to officer school, and in the middle of the officer school, I opened the daily paper and I see this huge headline, Yoav Shaham was killed last night in a raid. And that shattered me. It totally devastated me, because I knew, first of all, I loved the man. And then I knew that that's the end of the Mossad dream. And what I didn't know is that he already spoke to Meir Amit. Now, Meir Amit was a head of Mossad. And Meir Amit activated a guy called Aharon Yariv. Aharon Yariv was, you know, head of military intelligence. And he was the one that contacted me, Aharon Yariv. And from Aharon Yariv and from Meir Amit, I was introduced to Moshe Dayan, from Moshe Dayan to Arik Sharon, from Arik Sharon to Golda Meir, who was the Prime Minister of Israel. By then, I also met Benjamin Netanyahu, who is currently the Prime Minister of Israel. So you can imagine I circulated in the right places with the right people in the right positions. That's when I was asked to work for them, which I did. And then a letter went out from an Israeli scientist to another American scientist who knew Andrea Puharich, telling him about me. And because Andrea had ties to the CIA, and I don't know if you knew that, they were very interested in getting Uri Geller to America to be studied, to see how they could use me, because the Israelis were amazed by the information I was giving them, but they didn't know how I did it, and they wanted to know the know-how, how the mind works, how the brain works, and only the Americans could help them with that. And that's when Andrea Puharich comes to Israel. By that time, I was quite down. I was kind of... Everyone saw me in Israel. I was at my low point. The auditoriums that I used to fill up, 500-600 people, 1,000 people, were beginning to empty on me. And I found myself performing in nightclubs. It was humiliating. It was terrible. I thought, this is the end of Uri Geller. And one day, in a nightclub called The Cave, Hame'ara, in Old Jaffa, this man sits at the end of the table there, at the end of the nightclub, and he lifts up his hand and he kind of says, come over to my table. And I get over to his table, he gets up and he says, my name is Andrea Puharich, I'm an American doctor, and let me tell you this, what I've seen you do on this stage, any magician can do, but I kind of believe in what I've seen you do. Do you mind if I test you? And I said, who are you? What do you want from me? Well, he says, if you're real, I will take you to the United States, to America. Now, when I heard America, again, you must understand, this is, you know, after the war, after I was wounded, this is at my low ebb of, you know, Uri Geller in Israel.
Mm-hmm.
and hearing the word America, to me that meant gold, wow, fame, fortune.
Right.
And yes, so Andrea was the one that took me out of Israel.
Now, before we continue the story there and talk a little bit more about that, do you, what kind of things did you show to the Israeli and the military people, the intelligence people there, and then why ultimately were they interested in that? Did they believe you and said, this guy is for real, we got to bring him into the fold to use his abilities in our campaigns?
Oh, yeah, in their missions. Yeah, because, you know, I've done certain things to Aharon Yariv that freaked him out. Moshe Dayan used me. I can't remember if that's in the documentary. He was an amateur collector of amazing archaeological artifacts.
Yeah, that's right.
And he got me out in the middle of the night, 1 o'clock in the morning, with his Jeep and his driver to take me to, you know, to the beaches of Ashkelon and Tel Aviv, Jaffa, and look for artifacts. And I used to douse, and I would tell him, here, dig here, Moshe. And he would pull out his shovel and dig, and indeed, you know, we found what he was looking for. So he knew that what I did was real. But they didn't know how it manifested in me. So after doing quite a few missions for Israel, I was ready to go to America. And, you know, to me, America was, my goodness, am I really going to be in America? That's the way I thought of the you know, the land of gold on the pavement.
Right. Now, what kind of artifacts did you find for Moshe there? Because I stumbled across that too in another article, and was very interested in that alone, that he were interested in ancient ones 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 years old. That's all around in Israel area. What kind of stuff were you looking for, or he looking for?
I didn't find hundreds, maybe a dozen, if at all. Some of them were lamps, you know, old oil lamps. Some were just broken, chipped pieces of sculptures, old stones that were probably out of eclectic buildings. I remember that I found a hand. I don't remember if it was made from stone or marble, but I found some very unusual archaeological artifacts for him. And he used to display them in his garden, by the way.
Was there anything like valuable, really ancient stuff?
They were all ancient.
That's very interesting. Now, Puharich as well, I think he wanted to attempt to try to find out where your abilities came from, pretty much. And in this one story, this is when he hypnotized you, he bumps into Spectra, right? Can you tell us about that?
Correct. Okay, what you're about to hear now, and I warn all your listeners, you know, switch into a mode of science fiction and beyond your belief system.
And we're used to that too, Yuri, by the way, on this program, so no worries about
okay.
that. Yeah, go ahead.
But what you're about to hear is true. It's real, and it happened. And there is no way I can really wind myself out of this, because these are facts. And this is why I wrote about them in my books. And I knew that the skeptics will have a field day trying to debunk me with these incredibly amazing stories that were not stories, they were not science fiction, and they were not fiction. They were tangible and real and true. So one day, Puharich, after seeing me do all kinds of little tests that he lined up for me, he actually rented a small flat in Herzliya, which is a kind of a suburb of Tel Aviv. And he had his little Nikons and little Sony. You're going back 40 years. So it was amazing for me to see a movie camera, because in Israel, only very few people owned movie cameras. They were all very wealthy families. I've never seen a movie camera. I didn't even have a television. You know, my dream was to buy my mother a TV set, a black and white one. I mean, when we wanted to see television, we had to go to the backyard of the our neighbor who had a television, and the whole neighborhood was watching the television through the window. So you see, to me, these were incredible things that Andrea brought with him to test me. And then one day he says to me, "Look, Uri, I want to hypnotize you. I want to go back and see where this power emanates from and what you're about." And I agreed to be hypnotized. I think I'm a good, I was a good hypnotic subject for him. And he hypnotized me. Now, I cannot remember what happened while he hypnotized me, but he told me that I would tell stories of spacecrafts and use the word spectra and Hoover, and I would describe him military situations in Israel. It was quite astounding. There were points where, and I'll be quite frank with you, Henrik, that I thought the man was fooling me.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that Andrea Puharich was bluffing me. I thought he wanted to take over Uri Geller, and there were times where I, when he wasn't in the flat, I opened his Sony tape recorder and I tore it apart, because I was looking for tapes that would materialize out of this Sony, I think it was a TC-120, to the best of my recollection. So I thought that I was being, you know, hoodwinked by this genius who came from America, who was a doctor. But it wasn't. It was real. It happened. All the stories that you have read in my books, my story, The Geller Effect, and that came from me, are true. Obviously, the internet, you know, anyone can write anything about you.
Sure.
And unfortunately, that's the internet. It's good and bad. So Wikipedia probably has been hijacked by skeptics, and they can write whatever you want about Uri Geller or about anyone.
Yeah.
So that's what I can tell you, that there were these incredible encounters that we had. I've never seen an alien, but I have seen UFOs. So I fell into almost a Svengali Rasputin type of a figure.
Right.
And I truly believe that we were in touch with some higher force, some superior entity that was guiding us and telling us what to do. Let me just complete this pattern of thought. And then he calls Edgar Mitchell, an astronaut, who was the sixth man to walk on the moon. And I'm totally mind blown. You know, the space and walking on the moon, I only see in newspapers, in pictures, in my local Israeli newspaper, and then he talks to Edgar Mitchell. And Edgar Mitchell sends me a signed autographed picture of him walking on the moon. So what am I to think? Do you understand? I was in such a time, in such a arena and belief system, that I totally and utterly believed in everything Andrea Puharich told me.
Now, was that a mistake, do you think, or was there something to this? I mean, what I've heard and read here is that spectra is what is believed to be basically a kind of an entity, to be a conscious supercomputer of sorts aboard a spaceship. Is that true?
Henrik, look, when you say, was it a mistake? No, of course it wasn't a mistake. And until today, until this very day, I totally believe 100% in everything that happened. I 100% believe in every word I heard, because he used to play these tapes for me back and forth. I 100% believe that there must be some kind of an entity out there, that maybe is trying to communicate not only with me, but with many other individuals around the world.
Right.
What's the big deal, Henry? Come on.
No, and of course, this is like Volus from Philip K. Dick. Remember his story of Volus? It's very similar to that.
If you look at the universe and outer space, I mean, you know the movie, what a waste of space it would be if there were no UFOs. Of course there is life in outer space. Of course, because there is infinity. Infinity means no end. So it would be foolish from us, humans, to discount that maybe there is life out there. But when Andrea went back to America and then took me with him, and when I was kind of thrown it into Stanford Research Institute, unknown to me that the CIA was financing all this, then the reality dawned on me. And when these incredible phenomena which would start happening, the phenomena happened in many different laboratories, from Stanford Research Institute to the Lawrence Livermore Radiation Labs, where they build nuclear weapons.
Yep.
Then it continued at the American Naval Surface Weapons Center. These are laboratories that I can talk about, but there were others that I cannot talk about. And the stories of scientists encountering incredible entities in those laboratories, scientists that build nuclear weapons. This is not from Uri Geller anymore. These are from credible persons, people, individuals who are scientists. Then, of course, this to me validates that period that I was together with Buharich in Tel Aviv.
Was your abilities, were they originating from Spectra, do you believe? What happened to you? How do you do the things that you do?
Well, what happened to me is a very interesting situation occurred when I was about 5, 6, or 7 years old. It's very difficult for me to pin down, but I do believe that I was about 6 because of some recent validation from someone. But this is what happened. Opposite our apartment building in Tel Aviv, I lived in Bezalel Yaffe Street, number 13. Opposite our apartment building, this was a Bauhaus building, was an Arabic garden. That Arabic garden doesn't exist anymore. There's a big bank that was built on that land. I was playing in that garden and I heard kittens cry. And as a 6-year-old, I was looking for them. The next thing I can remember, and this was very vivid still in my mind, there appeared a massive sphere of light, and it was strobing. It was in front of me. It was maybe 2 meters in height. I was just, you know, transfixed by it. The next thing I remember was a beam of light shot out of it, almost like a laser beam, and hit my forehead. It was very powerful, and it pushed me into the grass. I don't know how long I lay there. But I remember myself running home to tell my mother of this extraordinary event. My mother brushed it off. She said, "No, you must have fallen asleep. You dreamt this up, or you're making this up." And I told her, "No." I called my mother Muti. I said, "No, Muti in Hungarian and half Hebrew. It really happened." But she didn't believe me. But this was so powerful that I could not walk away from this. That's why I wrote about it in the Geller, my story, and in the Geller effect, and in every book, in every article that I wrote or I was interviewed, for, I mentioned this occurrence.
Yep.
Now, about 8 years ago, the BBC did quite a few documentaries about me, and one of them was called, I forgot what it's called, but it was, Reputation. And in it, I tell the story of the fear of light. And this documentary plays in Israel, broadcast in Israel about 8.5 years ago. And I get an email from an ex-retired Air Force officer, and says to me, "Mr. Geller, I just saw this documentary, and I must tell you, I was there. I saw you. I was a young Air Force, officer. I was walking on Rothschild Boulevard, corner of Bezalel Yafe, your street, and I saw a little boy in a garden with a white shirt and black curly hair, and I saw this huge, enormous sphere of light, and this little boy was running away from it, and this thing followed you, and it exploded on your apartment building and left a black, dark mark." I freaked out when I read this email. I immediately contacted him, called him up, and I said, "You know, his name is Avrahami. This is the first time in all these decades that someone actually validated my story." And I knew then that I wasn't dreaming this.
Have you consequently come any closer, maybe even use your own psychic ability to try to find out who or what or even why this happened to you?
No, I don't know. And you asked me, going back to your original question, do I think that I got my powers from aliens? No, or I don't know. I have a few theories. Maybe this sphere of light was an extraterrestrial encounter. That's my first theory, my most far-fetched one, my most far-out theory. My second theory, that this could have been a supernatural experience. Maybe those that you read in the Bible, you know, although please don't think that I'm trying to link myself into any biblical figure here. I don't, because I'm not a guru and I'm not a miracle worker and I never try to become a religious figure, and I'm not a healer. I'm Uri Geller with a freaky talent, or call it a curious, strange, bizarre skill to bend spoons. And even I today, I'm amazed how I instilled it into world culture. So going back to the question, my third theory is that it could have been some type of a geological phenomenon. You know, a gas, I don't know, the ground released some kind of an energy bubble. And my fourth theory is that, hey, Henrik, am I really talking to you? Do you really exist? Or am I making you up into my reality? Or are you making me up? Is there an Uri Geller, or is there a Henrik? Is it all in our consciousness? Is it all quantum entanglement? Is it all beyond reality? Is it all a different dimension? I don't know. And that is my fourth theory.
Very interesting. Now, there's, of course, much more to this that we could get into here as well. I wanted to ask you, you mentioned the tapes earlier when you were in communication, I guess, then, or doing some of the experiments with SRI, etc. Do you know if there's any of those tapes still around today?
I wish they were, but I am in touch with Andre's son, Andy, who lives in Holland. And Andy was gracious enough to give me all the 8mm tapes that Andrea filmed in that apartment in Herzliya and in our trips in Israel. So actually, you can actually see quite a few of them in a documentary called Uri Geller, A Life Stranger Than Fiction, which is actually on Hulu.com in America. I urge you to watch it, because there's a lot of that home movies Andrea did, but the tapes I don't know where they are. I'm sure they are somewhere, because Andrea would not destroy them. Some of them would just dematerialize in front of our very own eyes, but I'm sure Andrea kept some. Where they are, I don't know. His son doesn't have them.
Okay. Well, that's a good tip there on the documentary. We'll have to check that out. Now,
if we're talking about tapes that disappear, one of the experiments that I conducted at Stanford Research Institute, or were conducted on me, and by the way, you can see the full experimentation on my website, which is urigeller.com. It's called the Secret CIA Experiment. It's on my homepage. Also, the BBC documentary, The Secret Life of Uri Geller, is on my homepage, and also A Life Stranger Than Fiction. I think you'll find it all amazing if you're into this stuff, and this stuff is real. I love the word stuff because it is tangible. So one of the tests, they asked me to materialize a watch, a wristwatch that was in the suitcase. If I'm not mistaken, it belonged to Hal Puthoff. Hal Puthoff was one of the experimenters. And everything was filmed constantly by a cameraman called Zev. I can't remember his family name now, but he filmed everything with a few cameras. And I tried, it didn't work. And suddenly, we heard this clang, a crash on the experimentation table, which was made out of lucite, so you can see through it. And the watch appears. And, you know, they ran the film back, and you can actually see the watch materializing in midair, falling, then dematerializes, then it materializes again and falls on the table. And that film disappeared. Where? Probably it's somewhere lodged in the safe of the CIA.
Interesting. Now, before we proceed in the chronology and talk more about the kind of work that you did for the Mossad and the CIA, etc., the remote viewing program and everything else that's related to this, which is very interesting, let me return to Poharidge again here for a moment and just ask you a little bit more about, you know, with his roundtable, he was into something called the Nine, the Ennead, channeling kind of the ancient principles of the creators, I guess, that was one version of this. Did you have do you have anything to say about this or any input, any comments on the Nine? Did you encounter any of this or were part of that in any way?
The only comment that I can say, and again, to the best of my recollection, we're talking about 40 years ago, the Nine were mentioned in one of these hypnotic sessions that he put me under. When I was in deep trance, I guess I mentioned the Nine. I had absolutely no idea what that meant. Later on, obviously, when the book came out, Uri, which was published by Doubleday, strangely enough, believe it or not, Jacqueline Kennedy had something to do with that book. When that book was published, that's when I learned a lot about Poharidge.
Yeah, because he, of course, had a more, shall we say, sinister side as well. As an army doctor in the 1950s, he was deeply involved with the, you know, CIA's notorious MK Ultra mind control project. He was
I'd like to change that word. I wouldn't call him sinister because he was a great guy. He was a gentleman. He was an amazing individual. Let me tell you this. Without Andrei Poharidge, I wouldn't be talking to you now. He made Uri Geller. I mean, he took me out of Israel, where out of the borders of Israel, I was totally and utterly unknown. Then obviously I had a huge showdown with him. Things flew in his Ossining home. Grandfather clocks levitated, banged against the walls, glass tables shattered. I mean, incredible, because I had to get out of the clutches of Poharidge. He owned me. He made me sign an agreement, a contract, written up by his lawyers, where he owned Uri Geller. I couldn't do anything. I couldn't write anything. It was totally and utterly signed to him, totally binding in a legal way.
And so you guys had a falling out of sorts there, 73?
Huge,
what happened there?
Huge falling out.
Yeah.
Well, I wanted to write my story. I had to, because when his book came out, it was a disaster. It was so controversial. I mean, I think it was booed in one of the universities. He you know, the real scientist looked at him as a joke. This was terrible. It was, but he just kept believing, and I kept believing. And we knew that we had a mission to do, but I had to get out of the prison I was in. And I'll tell you exactly what happened. This is probably the first time ever I cover this side of my story with Andrea. The book was bought, I think, by 60 countries around the world. I mean, the book Uri, which you can read on my website, it's free to read. I allow most of the books that I write and some of them that were written about me, just get on my website, go to books, go to free books, and Andrea's book is there for you to read. Because I was a prisoner in Ossining, 47 Hawks Avenue in New York, you know, that's where Sing Sing is, and I'll never forget the days when they executed people in Sing Sing and the lights in his house dimmed. I then broke away from him and went to New York. I met a renowned American classical pianist called Byron Janis, who is married to Maria Janis Cooper, who is Gary Cooper's daughter.
Right.
And we became best of friends. And it was Byron who loaned me $40,000 and said, give it back when you have it, to rent an apartment and buy furniture. And Andrea said to me, okay, you got out of Ossining, but you've got to come with me to London to promote my book, Uri. And I said, no, Andrea, I'm not going to promote it unless you release me. You have to release me. And this is after that unbelievable fight I had with him in his home, where things were flying all around the room. And I forced him to release me from his contract, and then I agreed to promote the book with him. And I guess you're the first person that hears his story.
Very good, very good. Now, Puharic, together with, Sidney Gottlieb, was involved. I just want to return to that for a moment. In the MKUltra mind control program, they've experimented with various techniques to change or induce thought process, eventually creating the impression of voices in the head. The other techniques included the use of drugs, of course, hypnosis, beaming radio signals directly into the subject's brain, etc., under, the CIA mind control experiment. Was that anything that you were part of in any way at all? Did you participate in some of the experiments there?
I have, but I cannot talk about that because they are linked to certain military aspects and secret agencies in quite a few continents. But Andrea was onto something really big and doable. Doable, that is the word. And obviously it was, military aspects and Air Force and Navy, they all wanted to share the knowledge and use the knowledge. And what you read and what is out there on the internet about Andrea is real, is true, and it is probably still being used, but more polished and more technologized.
Right,
today.
Right, exactly. Now, certain aspects of the MKUltra program have obviously been released under the Freedom of Information Act, but are there still non-disclosure agreements from your end that ties you from talking more about it then?
I won't mention whether I have non-disclosure agreements, but I will tell you this, that I will not talk about it. I will not deny it, and I won't admit to anything, but let me say this. The majority of skeptics out there who try to debunk Uri Geller, I was their main target. My controversies developed already in Israel before I left Israel. I was attacked by scientists in Israel, by magicians who called me a fraud, and that all this was magic and trickery, etc., etc. And being very young then, I thought, oh, that's going to destroy me. This is it. This is the end of Uri Geller. But every time a story came out, whether it was negative or positive, I sold more tickets to my shows. I didn't understand that phenomenon. But whenever I had a big show in a theater in Israel, no matter what they wrote about me, more people came to see me until I totally exhausted the audiences because they've seen me three or four times or five times. And because I'm not a magician, I couldn't change my act. I had and still have a very narrow repertoire because it's real. So I couldn't materialize an elephant on the stage. So people tired, and that's why I found myself in nightclubs. But what Andrea was dealing with is very real. And the skeptics who think that there is no more remote viewing programs and no more secret stuff going on in the paranormal realm are dead wrong.
Of course.
Listen very carefully to what Scott Jones says in the Secret Life of Uri Geller documentary, in the uncensored one. Listen to his words. Listen to Vikram Jayanti's questioning Scott Jones. And Vikram Jayanti, the Oscar-winning director, is questioning Scott, and Scott answers something very brilliant.
The program went black, but I couldn't tell you that. I think your logic is very powerful, right? That's what he repeats.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You're a great interviewer, Henrik. I commend you, because I've been interviewed by hundreds and hundreds of people, but I love the way you let people talk and the way you construct your questions, and your voice is very, very powerful. It's very young. How old are you?
I'm 34.
Yeah, you sound like a teenager.
Well, thank you for that, I guess.
And I bet you look also 20.
20? I don't know about that, but, you know, you try to stay young in spirit, right? But anyway, we're going to take a break here in a little bit, Yuri. We're going to pick up here. Obviously, I want to ask you more about the remote viewing program, all the things related to this. There's so much more fascinating stuff here. But let's just give out some of the details here again. Or you mention your website, mention the title of the books and everything.
If you allow me, let me plug a few things. I would very much like you to read The Secret Life of Uri Geller. It's written by Jonathan Margolis, a Financial Times journalist. You can see the movies, the documentaries on my homepage. My website is urigeller.com. Get the book from Amazon. He's a brilliant, brilliant writer, especially if you're a CIA agent or if you're an FBI agent or if you're a police officer or if you're a national security agency agent. Or any serviceman anywhere, or just you people who are interested in UFOs, the mind power, and the latest espionage scandals, you must read The Secret Life of Uri Geller.
Very good. UriGeller.com. We'll have that linked up and some of the books and titles as well. Stay with us, Yuri. We'll take a short break here, and we'll be right back with more after this.
One flash of light, yeah, one God.
All right, we have much more coming up here in a little bit. We'll proceed at redicemembers.com with Uri Geller, and we're going to ask him about 9/11, if he was part in locating Saddam or Osama bin Laden or anything else of this nature, and we get some interesting answers or reactions rather to some of these questions as well, so don't miss this. And we'll of course continue to talk more about his time as a psychic spy, Israel, the CIA, Mossad, and everything else. Subscribe at redicemembers.com. We have tons of shows for you available on all kinds of topics that we find interesting and valuable to learn more about. We have more programs coming up, of course. Next is on the strange murder case of Swedish Annie Börjesson, who died in Scotland a few years ago now. We are going to talk with her mother, Guja Börjesson, and with Tom Minogue, who has been raising legal issues related to this case at the Parliament in Scotland. After this, we have Dane Wigington on geoengineering. We also have Kevin MacDonald, Stephen McNallan, Sophia Smallstorm, and Mark Weber. All right, we'll pick this up right after the break. Join us at redicemembers.com.